This is the start of tape two of the October 9, 1986 interview with George Kervin.
Okay.
And so they had a festival which they called Harbor Day. This was like the seafood festival started, Harbor Day. They had a celebration celebrating the harbor, having a channel opened up to Columbus, Georgia, where we could come from Columbus, Georgia and go out into all parts of the world. Well, the first year that Jim Woodruff Dam was closed off, it held our fresh water up, and our bay turned salty for the first time. And here come the conchs, here come the leeches, here come the predators that live in the salt water and no fresh water to keep them out. By that action, we lost Porter's Bar. It died, the conchs ate it up. In the same action, we lost the whole south end of St. Vincent's Dry Bar. The conchs ate it up. The bed's still there, and the oysters would go if it wasn't for the predators for the conchs. And so, of course, then we turned Harbor Day into Seafood Festival Day and celebrated our seafood industry, and in turn organized to fight the damming and changing of the Apalachicola River and all. So ever since that time, with Jim Woodruff Dam up there, we have been plagued with high salinity, salty water entering into our bay, and conchs entering into our bay. Read an article yesterday which it said one conch consumed 35 oysters a year in his season. I mean, that's mature, that's big oysters. They consume 35 oysters a year. Well, the bottom out there in that bay is literally covered in conchs. It's just unbelievable. When I was in the oyster business, and the conchs come in usually in the dry weather, you know, and in the warm weather. And I told my oystermen, they told me, they said that conchs is literally eating the oysters up out there. I said, bring them in. When you tongue up them conchs, I said, throw them in your boat and I'll give you $1 a bushel for them. Well, at that time, their oysters was only $1.50 a bushel. I said, I'll give you $1 a bushel for every conch you brought in. So they brought them in, and we measured them up, and I paid them for them, and we piled them out on the beach there, and I poured gasoline on them, set them fire. And then, in turn, I carried them down to my lease and used them for oyster course, you know. And they did this for a few weeks, and then they decided, the oystermen said, you're paying out money to protect us, and we don't want to charge, we want to kill the conchs. So I said, okay, if that's what you want, okay, good and fine. But anyhow, it kind of died away. And I have advocated all through the years driller control. Now, up north, they call them drillers. We call them conchs, oyster conchs. And I believe what I know about the bay, I believe that the conchs destroys more oysters than the oysterman ever catches. Because the conchs is out there 12 months out of the year, 24 hours out of the day, and he's steady working on them all the time, and there's literally millions of them in that bay out there. When I was in Chesapeake Bay and Nanticoke Sound and up in there where they harvest oysters, they had a program where that they trapped conchs, and that would be a square frame, metal frame, with hardware cloth, you know, laced into it, and they would have rope coming from each corner of it to a cord. And in the center of that there, when it sunk down to the bottom, they had an old beef bone or some kind of fish or something they fastened to it. And those conchs would crawl up on it, and there would be piles of them that high, a bushel of them, on them, and they would take them and pour them into the boats, bait the trap, set her back down. And then they would take these to the beach and, of course, destroy them, burn them, and then use the shield just like I used it. That's where I landed at, was up there. And all but then in the 70s, I noticed that they invented a vacuum sweeper. And I begged these people, the conservation department, I begged them to us during this time that we had this giveaway program that they claimed the Lena and Kate destroyed the bay. They ain't what destroyed the bay. They'd been overworked. The bay was destroyed before Lena and Kate ever come. Now, Lena and Kate did some damage to the bay. But then again, the bay was overworked. There was too many people working and nothing being put back. It had already been destroyed. And they was catching small oysters. No law enforcement, no penalty for the violation when they were caught. And so anyhow, when they had this time that they was in trouble getting work to do, the oystermen, I asked Gisson Danner, I asked the Oystermen's Association, the Dealers Association, I said, you're getting millions of dollars, thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to plant oysters and do all of this work. And I said, why in the world don't you just give them so much a bushel to trap comps and rid this bay of comps? Sound good, but they never done it. That's right. So, proper planting the bay by leasing, private leasing, good conservation, I mean good conservation, good law enforcement, a program to try to rid the bay of these conchs by either trapping or by this vacuum. I noticed that in the paper article that I read, it said that the Chesapeake Bay and those bays up there that harvested at oysters was about 95% ridded of conchs. They had no conchs up there now. We could do the same thing in Apalachicola Bay and spend a whole lot less money than what we waste around for a lot of other other things. And I don't mind being quoted on all this. Any other questions you'd like to ask me?
I was wondering if the men who are oystering, are they participating in other kinds of fisheries too, or are they mainly sticking to oystering throughout the year?
Well, the oystermen, at the time I was in oyster business, in 1965, we opened the bay up for summertime oystering. We kept it open for 3 years, and I seen, together with everybody else, that we were destroying the bay. So we got together, and we asked for the bay to be closed for the 3 months of the year. And of course, the oystermen during the season, the 9 months in the season, they oystered. That's all they did. They oystered and they worked hard. Then I said, the man that made that much money in 3 months and worked that hard in 3 months deserved a 3 month vacation. And let him go floundering, let him go trout fishing, or whatever he wanted to do, let him go carpentering, do whatever he wanted to. And it worked out real sure enough good. Now, since they have seen fit, and they did this while I was in the hospital with this cancer. The county commissioners drafted a resolution from a recommendation from the Oystermen's Association to open the bay up 12 months out of the year for oystering. And when I came home from the hospital and I learned about it, I was very much upset about it. However, there was not very much I could do about it. I asked the Chamber of Commerce to encounter it and draft a resolution opposing what the county commissioners had done, but we failed to do it. So anyhow, the oystermen, most of the oystermen, they do that for a living. Now, during this harvesting of this crop of little baby shrimp on this nursery ground, a lot of them will take their oyster boat and put a net on it and will shrimp during the right in the heart of the catching of those little baby shrimp. And but as a whole, an oysterman is an oysterman. As a whole, a shrimper is a shrimper. And they pretty well stick to their profession, and they're good at it. I've tried that oyster. I went out there and I tried it. I wouldn't do it. No way.
It's hard work, yeah.
And there's an art to it. It's got to be. Those men out there that I know, I was a good man. And to manhandle them tongs with a pile of oysters on one end of them, I couldn't do it. That's right. But those other men that wasn't no better man than I was, they could do it with all these all day long. So I say that there's something in knowing how.
Absolutely.
And I kind of take my cap off to them for being able to do that. That's right, yeah.
Speaking about techniques and knowing how, you were mentioning the women that were your shuckers. Has it always been women that have been shuckers at oyster houses around here?
95%. In my oyster house, I've probably out of the 50 to 65 shuckers, I probably had three or four men shuckers, but the women could have shuckers. Women are better workers than men. As a whole.
Are there different techniques that women use to open oysters, or does everyone do it the same way?
Well, no. Of course, the old method, you know, is a what they call an oyster block. You're probably familiar with that, a piece of iron with a kind of a wedge thing shaped welded to it, you know. And they'd lay the oyster on that and hit him with a hammer, you know, and break his bill off and then stick a knife in him, you know, which created a lot of shell in the oysters. And then Roy Smith, who is dead now, Roy Smith invented this oyster machine, shucking machine, that has a rotating blade on it, and they're very dangerous, very dangerous. I put them in my house, but I took them out. Later, he put more safety device on them. But now then, most of the shuckers, I think, use this, where they take the oyster, shove it against this rotating cutter, and it just cuts the bill off to where they can stick their knife in and shuck it. Of course, in our system, the last 5 years of our being in the oyster business, it was completely done by the process of shock treatment. And the oysters was now with the heat treatment, the shock treatment, the Hank patent. That was a pre-cooked oyster. But by using the CO2, the oyster was not a pre-cooked oyster. He was still alive. He would close back up and live. You put him back in water. Is right. And that's the three methods. Now, some of the men would do what they call heel oysters, you know. And that's hinge them. They could have a special kind of a knife they stick into this hinge, you know, and break the hinge on an oyster and shuck them that way. But that never was very successful. That I know of.
Are there different names for oysters of different sizes or shapes?
Yes, sir. of course, there is the different type oyster. There is a cup oyster that was largely grown on St. Vincent's Dry Bar, a cup oyster. And that was a kind of a round cup-shaped oyster, something like a quahog clam, you know. And then there was the scissorbill oyster, which was a longer oyster, a thinner oyster, and grew much faster. That's the kind I grew on my lease, is right. And it taken the scissorbill oyster about 14 months to grow to be a lawful oyster. However, I was bitterly opposed to harvesting them at that time because they grew thin and the shell was tender and they were more or less little sprouts, little young sprouts of oysters, not a half an inch thick and not an inch and a quarter or 2 inches wide. My oysters on my lease, I never harvested one under 28 months. He'd give him time to become a strong, adult oyster, mm-hmm. and the shell was strong. The tongs would not cut through the mm-hmm. shell. And I harvested them at around 28 to 32 months after I put the bleached shell in the water and the spat gathered to them. Mm-hmm. And but however, the state program, they start harvesting when they're about, been in the shell, who've been in the water about 14 months. And of course, that's what you call standard oysters. Run over 32 count to the pint. And your select oysters run from 32 to less per pint. And my oysters that I harvested on my lease, many of them were sold as selects, but I sold a lot of them as counts, mm-hmm. which the counts is 20 and under, where the selects is under 32 mm-hmm. count to the pints, you know. And that is a different size oysters, and of course a different species of oyster. Mm-hmm. There's a cup oyster and then what we call a scissor bill oyster. Mm-hmm. I guess in Franklin County there's more scissor bills produced than any other type. Mm-hmm. Oyster is right.
Mm-hmm. Are there terms that about describing oysters that fishermen would know that other people may not? For example, I heard someone talking about coon oysters the other day.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
The coon oysters was, you know, God's creation was white. I want you to know I'm a Christian. I believe there's a God, and I believe there's a creator. I believe he created all things. And I believe over there in Genesis, the first chapter, in verse 28, somewhere along in there, that when he was talking to Adam and Eve, and he said to them, he said, go forth and multiply and subdue mm-hmm. and take care of this creation I've given you. I think this has been the most misunderstood passage of scripture in the Bible. I think most people have said, thought to themselves, this means to have children. Mm-hmm. And one translation of the Bible says, many children. Mm-hmm. We know what multiplying and overpopulating has done to different countries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It'll destroy. And God didn't intend it that way. God intended for us to take what he gave us, our timber, our natural resources, work with it, protect it, and build upon it. Just like in this bay, he gave us less than 4% of the bay that was commercial beds, but he gave us, DNR says 47%, and I say 80% is ideal for planting. Mm-hmm. So God intended for us to plant it. That's right. Mm-hmm. As the population grew, everything else should grow in accordance with it. And we should work with it. We should conserve it. We should take care of it. And promote it. That's right. So, the question you asked me, I think, this is pretty well answered it in my mm-hmm. own way. Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, I've just got a couple more questions for you.
Okay.
We were talking earlier, when you were talking to me about your earlier fishing experiences, about how complicated it is to find fish or to describe how that is done. I was wondering about different, how much the weather is involved in finding fish and types of things or conditions that you would look for to tell you, for example, that the weather is going to be bad and it's time to go back in.
Well, I fished a large commercial fishing boat for a number of years and a crew of 14 men on her most of the time. And then also involved the other boat that I was more or less directing by radio most of the time. And the Weather Bureau, I was never able to put a lot of confidence in it. Mm-hmm. I had my barometer. I watched the moon changes. And I backed up my own judgment pretty well concerning weather conditions, and weather conditions in that moon controls pretty well the seafood industry. Mm-hmm. I had men on my boat that always was listening for a weather report and all, and during hurricane season, I listened to your hurricanes. I kept mm-hmm. them spotted. I knew where mm-hmm. they were at, and I had great respect for them. But normal weather conditions, I would not allow a man to come aboard my boat and tell me what the weather report was for the day,
mm-hmm.
because it confused me.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather rest myself, look at my barometer, and the condition of the moon and the sky, the cloud formation, I could pass my own judgment, and 90% of the time I'd hit it
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing that, of course, it had a tremendous effect on my fishing. This was one of the things, together with knowing the tide, knowing when your tide is going to change and the effect that it's going to have on water, the flow of water miles away from the pass. You take Bob Sykes Channel, for an instance, down here. A lot of people want to close it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Bob Sykes Channel opened up the shrimping industry to Apalachicola. Before that, we was restricted to little small shallow drafted boats, you know, that worked in the bay and worked around the beaches out here. When we built Bob Sykes Channel, Bob Sykes Channel opened up the Gulf to where we could build large boats and go to all parts of the Gulf and harvest and come back in through Bob Sykes Channel.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people think it's destroying the oysters. Well, the water that flows into Bob Sykes Channel, right here, Sykes Cut,
mm-hmm.
when it flows in, most of the oysterman feels that salt water goes all over the bay, scatters all over the bay, and raises the salinity in the bay and kills your oysters and allows the predators to come in.
Mm-hmm.
This water flushes in so heavy when it runs, it's a narrow cut, it flushes in so heavy until it never reaches out further. Normally, I flew over it, I've watched it, and I've worked with it,
mm-hmm.
and all, it never affects this water over in here
mm-hmm.
at all, because mm-hmm. the water comes out, and this bay is open at each end of the bay.
Mm-hmm.
The water flows through the bay this way,
mm-hmm.
and the water flows through this way. This is the reason this bay can wash itself. God made it.
Because it's going from east to west.
East to west. You can have an easterly spell of weather, and it'll flush the water out of this bay, and it'll go off the Cape and blast off into the Gulf. You can have a westerly spell of weather, and it flushes it the same way, the other direction. So at running this way, at the speed and the force that it runs, the water that comes in Bob Sykes Channel comes in with a gush, and it don't go out very far, because if this water's running this way, it begins to turn
mm-hmm.
and flow this way. Same thing in westerly weather, it begins to turn and flow this way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it gets to running so hard here going out, until it begins to pull back,
mm-hmm.
an eddy current
mm-hmm.
begins to pull back, and this thing begins to pull around, and it causes a circulation,
mm-hmm.
and then the water goes back out
yeah.
when the tide turns out. She's mm-hmm. running, and I know this.
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the, right here, right west of Bob Sykes Channel, when I commercially fished, was one of my best places of sitting,
mm-hmm.
because I knew exactly when to sit, when that water was still gushing in, and yet it started pulling back, and when it got eddy, that's when I would sit on the fish and
mm-hmm.
catch boatloads of them.
Mm-hmm.
Is right. So anyhow, this does not, which a lot of people think that it does, affect the bay, the oysters. However, for fishing, my type fishing, it does affect. When they built this field, which I bitterly opposed to it. I
mm-hmm.
said it ought to be a piling bridge.
Mm-hmm.
This here is piling bridge. This is field here in the middle of the bay,
right.
And here's another field right here.
Right.
This restricts the flow of the water through this bay that caused our bay ever since it built that thing our bay has been polluted a lot of the time because it don't have the flushing. This restricts the flushing. And the great reason that it restricts the flushing, it will run through where it's restricted here. It will run through to the extent that it begins to pull back.
Mm-hmm.
It begins to do the same thing it does with Bobby Sachs Channel.
Right.
It begins to run through heavy here, but then again it goes to turning back in
right.
here.
Right.
Is right. So anyhow, the I used to be able to be on this end of the island, right here. I knew the bay so well.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the flow of the tide so well. I knew the work of the wind, the direction of the moon, condition, and all. And I could be here, and I knew exactly what the fish was doing right here.
Hmm.
Many times I have left this place right down here and give the boat to my crew, and I crawled in my bunk and went to sleep, and they'd taken their long straight shot and went to this end of the island, and when I got right there, I'd know what the tide was going to be when I get there.
Hmm.
Well, then I'd get a large catch of fish.
Yeah.
And this is true with the bay. You've got to know the bay, know the effect that the moon has upon the tide and the wind direction that it has upon the tide. Now, you go out here on Patton Bridge, and most people say when the tide is running through the bridge west, the tide's rising.
Mm-hmm.
When the tide's running through the bridge east, the tide's falling. This is the way they look at
mm-hmm.
it. And this is mostly true to a point.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you've got an easterly spell of weather, this tide is running through right on through continuously
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It very seldom ever turns back and
mm-hmm.
goes back here. And the same token with westerly weather. It gets the current running through the bay because this whole end of the bay is out down here, don't you see? And it comes through these passes down here, and you're passing this, and gets your water to run in this way.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way that God intended to rid the bay of pollution, in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
is right. By flushing this stuff out. I talked to Dr. Gissendiner. I was had the privilege of talking to a Boy Scout cavalry, and Dr. Gissendiner was there. And this is one of the things that I said we need to do, is to get rid of this fill out here in the bay. He agreed with me wholeheartedly. Of course, now is the proper time we should do it. It's been mostly a lot of it destroyed by
mm-hmm.
hurricanes,
mm-hmm.
and so on this, I noticed the bids on it, I believe, was better than $3 million to repair the fills. For $3 million, we can run a piling bridge from this bridge over
mm-hmm.
here on across to this bridge over here and connect it and dynamite this thing and turn it into oyster bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And he agreed with me wholeheartedly,
mm-hmm.
and I think it should be done. I think then we would rid our bay of the problem that we have of pollution at times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, too, it would increase our oyster beds, our oyster bottom. Then, in turn, it would be a safety route to get off of St. George's Island in case of a jumped-up storm or hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hurricane bills down in the Caribbean or down in that direction, we have plenty of time and notice to get off. But in the early season, this time of season, they build right here in the Gulf, and sometimes they build right on you.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And could be trapped a lot of people on St. George's Island,
yeah.
where if you had a piling bridge, you'd get off of it.
Yeah. Have there been many hurricanes here like the ones of last year?
Well, my lifetime, most all of our hurricanes have, it has entered the Gulf, has followed the Gulf Stream down. And they usually go in out from Mississippi west, Louisiana, Texas, out in there. They follow the Gulf Stream. However, depending on your cold waves and all that sometime, which in the case of Elena and Kate, both, there happened to be a cold wave coming down, that after they had already got past us out into West Gulf, and we thought we were free from them, we were sorry for those people out there, but then here come a cold front, which is more powerful than their hurricane force, and pushed them right back in on us,
mm-hmm.
is right. And I think this was a coincidence. I do not think I've been here for a long time, and I have seen bad hurricanes, and before my time in 1894, this island pretty well was covered and destroyed everything on it. But in my time, most all of our hurricanes has passed offshore of us and all, and we're not bothered by hurricanes very bad. I think this is a coincidence. Kate and Elena, I think it was just happening that the cool wave came at the wrong time.
Yeah. Well, I hope for everyone's sake around here it doesn't happen like that again for
a while. Well, I don't expect it. Could do it, but then again, some say that the hurricanes follow a pattern. This is not true. I've been here too long. That's right. They don't follow. Now, they follow the Gulf Stream because of the temperature of the water, you know. That's right. They follow that pretty well. That's right. But I say that it takes a hurricane occasionally along to wash your waters, your beaches, your bays. And without some bad weather, and I prefer not to have the hurricane itself, but I prefer to have the effect of the hurricane.
Yeah.
60, 65, 70 mile an hour winds with the tide with it washes the bay and does the bay good. I never will forget, we had one back that passed offshore of us and back, I believe, in the early 70s or late 60s, maybe in 68. And the government come in, they declared it an area of disaster, you know, and the government come in and offered grants and low interest loans. And a fellow came to me on for my lease. He said, "Mr. Craven, we are here to help you on your lease. And we can let you have some money on your lease and at a low interest loan." I said, "Well, I've made it all these years without any assistance from the federal government, and I still think I can make it. And I have already surveyed my lease, and it's cleaner, it's better. There's more oysters washed out from it now than there was before the hurricane." So I said, "It done me good, and it's done every other part of the bay good too." That's right. He thanked me very much and went on his way.
Yeah,
that's right. But I think a hurricane, or the effect of a hurricane, your tide and a reasonable amount of wind is good for our beaches, cleans. Without it, the silt and this stuff grows up and all, and the water becomes dirty and all. But to a hurricane, I think it cleanses it. It's God's way of cleaning it up. So that's right.
Did you ever get into any hard weather when you were fishing?
Plenty of it.
Yeah. Any close calls that way?
Well, yes. I got into two close calls. When I was a boy, 16 years old, my dad had put this commercial fishing boat, I was telling you about, the Mississippi in. There was no canal at Port St. Joe then, and it was generally known there was no harbor that you could put a boat in St. Joe Bay and protect her through a storm. Well, we were fishing. We had just recently moved to Apalachicola and was fishing here part-time, but then in mackerel season, we'd go back over and fish at Port St. Joe in the fall of the year, early fall of the year, and mackerel fish over in St. Joe. So at that time, a man by the name Paul Bailey was captain of my daddy's boat, and my brother and I was fishing on the boat. And so our boat was in St. Joe Bay, stationed at Mr. Kilburn's fish house. And so, of course, when we got the report that the Gulf was, this hurricane had entered the Gulf and was sweeping the coast, coming up the coast, it crossed the peninsula down here about Tampa, Fort Myers area, and just swept the coast all the way up. And it was due to come in here that night, and of course, we knew we'd lose our boat. And so I took it on myself, and I left Apalachicola and went to Port St. Joe. And I asked the captain, who was Paul Bailey, I said, my dad wants us to take the boat to Panama City where he can have harbor. He said, George, it'd take a crazy man to get on a boat in and out into that gulf. He said, we're already getting the fringe of the hurricane now. He said, our lives is worth more than any boat. So he said, I'm not going, and I advise you not to go. Well, there was a crew at that time of 10 men that was working on the boat, and I just challenged them all. I said, has anybody got the guts to go with him? And a man by the name of Jesse Shower said, I'll go with his older man, I was. And he said, I'll go with you. I said, okay, let's get aboard. And we got the boat fueled up, and we took off. Well, of course, the wind was very high and was from the northeast. And so we taken our course, it was raining, and we taken our course to run parallel with the beach, offshore far enough that you couldn't see the beach most of the time, to hit St. Andrews Pass, which at that time, it was the old pass, was the only pass they had. It didn't have the jetty and the rock jetty they have now. It was the old pass you had to have. And so we was running with a fair wind and running heavy. My motor was pretty well open and trying to, this was mid-afternoon, but this was happening there later. And so when we got off of Bell Shoals, which is about half the way to Panama City, we got off of Bell Shoals, I was a kid. I was 16 years old, and I didn't know the danger. And man, it got bad. I'm telling you right now, it got bad. And I said to the older man, Jesse Shower, I said, you know, we may not make it. I said, this is getting bad, and we may not make it. We were on our 45-foot boat, and about 12-foot beam, good seaworthy boat. And I said, we may not make it. He said, we can't go back. That's for sure. He said, we got to go with it. Mm-hmm. We can't turn back, because he said she wouldn't make it. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. And he said to me, he said, we'll go as far as we can. And he said, when she gets too bad, he said, we'll head her for the hill. And when she sinks, he said, we're both good swimmers. And he said, we'll make it ashore. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. Well, we made it to St. Andrew's Bar. And I would imagine it was about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was very late, beginning to get dark, and we couldn't see nothing, sheets of rain. And at the same time, I didn't know it, but the Galateer belonged to Pat Mangum. And Mr. C.J. Bryant was the owner of a Pat Mangum, Mr. First Captain. Well, she had tried to go across the bar just ahead of us, which it was a solid foam, solid breaker. Mm. And at that time, I imagine we were experiencing 65, 70 mile an hour winds. And so he tried to go in through the channel. And one of his had a two-cylinder engine, and one of the cylinders conked out, and he didn't have enough power to continue on. Mm-hmm. And so she turned sideways on him and rolled over and over. Boy. Broke the mast out of her, but however, they had nailed the hatches down, and she uprighted, and the stove, the front of the stove was in the top of the galley. And of course, I didn't know that this had happened, but it had happened just before we got there. We timed it after talking to them. Of course, they were swept back out to sea, and everybody thought they was lost. They was eventually found. But we got there in this condition. And when I seen that it was an impossibility for a boat of our kind to go across that bar, there was mountain seas running, and we were off out of the breaker part of it, but where you had to go through the channel, which was about a quarter of a mile, I guess, before you begin to get protection from the shallow waves on each side. Mm-hmm. Well, I told my buddy, Jesse Shower, I said, it's impossible. We can't make it. That was about 2 miles offshore, you know. The entrance to the channel was Nobody even let me swim ashore and that kind of work. So I rounded the boat back up offshore, and I told Jess, I said, we can't make it. That sheer capsized for turning on the wind. He said, look, we got to make it. He said, we don't have no other direction to go. Mm-hmm. So knowing that there was a God, and I know that knew he was in charge of it all, I just said to him and to myself, take us across. Take us across Loch Penzance. So I called him, weather of that kind, you'll find a batch of large seas will come, and then there'll be a kind of a lull between them. The seas won't be as large. Then there'll come another batch mm-hmm. of tremendous large seas. And I knew my only hope to get through that was to get on a large sea, not a small sea. So I backed off, and the boat was run fast. And I got back off in the deep water. And as that sea was coming, and of course the edge of the sea was like this, and mountain high, I got the boat on that sea like this.
Just angled down.
Angled down, yeah. Bow down. And I'd venture to say that I held her, and, you know, she was continually trying to share on me. And if you slowed her down air ditch, you'd lose the sea, and that coma would turn you over. And then if you got too fast, don't you see, you got off of the sea you was on. Mm-hmm. I held her right on that sea on that same speed until we never lost it. We took her across into smooth water. Perfectly fine from there on. Of course, the wind was blowing and awful bad and choppy, you know, but we were safe. We carried the boat on into Panama City and put in the harbor. And I got in my car and came back. I had one of the crew to meet me over there in the car. I came back. Jesse Shiver dropped off at St. Joe where he lived. I came on to Apalachicola by myself. I drive in the beach route, which was the only route, and at Manibao, the bridge was awash. Mm. That whole highway, the seas was washing across it when I came back the beach route and all, but I made it home. Mm. When I got there, I found my dad and my mother was praying.
That's a powerful story.
Made the difference. Mm-hmm. Then again, I was caught in one, and that was caused from greed. I knew there was a hurricane. It was making 2-day trips at the time, and right down here at Goose Island, that's where I was at. And there was another fisherman there with me, and I had my radio, and I was keeping in touch with the hurricane, and it had crossed the peninsula right in the same area in the Tampa area and was headed for West Florida to hit in right in this area here. But in the cove, let's see if I can find it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right here in this cove right there. Mm-hmm. That's what they call Rattlesnake Cove. There, now then the park ranger station is right here, you know, where you buy your ticket to go in. Now this is East Slough right here. Mm-hmm. Well, I was laying right in this cove right here, another fisherman and I both was laying there, and the hurricane of course was reported coming on up because, and we was getting heavy winds, and so his boat was smaller than my boat, but in high wind for some reason fish would come up and they were dead right in this cove right mm-hmm. here. And mm-hmm. I'd get large sets of fish there mm-hmm. when it was high wind mm-hmm. and rough weather. And so I thought that I would be able to stay there and catch those fish. I knew they'd be there on the tide, and when the wind got high, I knew they'd be there because they worked up into that cove against that wind. And also, I went over to the other fisherman, which was a smaller boat than I, and I said to him, I said, that hurricane is just east of us. It's coming our way. I said, my advice to you is to try to get into the river. I should have took that advice myself. But through wanting to catch a boatload of fish, you know, mm-hmm. I decided to take a chance. Mm-hmm. And while I was talking, he was getting his anchor. And he headed for Apalachicola. It wasn't long before he was out of sight, rain blowing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I lay there and kept getting the weather report. And it kept worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And I forgot about the fish then. I decided, no, I don't want no fish. So I left this right here.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we didn't have the Patton Bridge at the time. We had the Gory Bridge right
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
It's right, there's no Patton Bridge. So I left here, and, of course, you couldn't see nothing. It was just blowing gale force winds and solid rain, sheets of wind. And so I took my course, and I headed for Gory Bridge
mm-hmm.
here. And when I got right here off of East Point, I had my radio, but then again, I didn't have a diesel engine in the boat. The ignition, the noise mm-hmm. would cut my radio out at high speed. I had to slow her down to get, you know, the broadcast
yep.
and all. So when I got right here off of this point there, East Point, I slowed her down and brought her. It was bad. It was really, really showing up bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen there was in trouble. So I slowed her down where I could get it, and I got it from Pensacola. That's where I got the weather forecast. Came from Pensacola. It said that they was experiencing hurricane force winds in Apalachicola. And if the hurricane was just to the southeast of us and was sweeping the coast, the eye would possibly pass just offshore, but we would get heavy winds.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew then there's no time to play around any longer, so I cut my radio off, and we'd taken the course for this bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we got to the bridge, we went through Cooking Channel, and we came on into Apalachicola. And when we got to Apalachicola, the docks was washing away. The boats, mm-hmm. there's no boats in the dock except my brother.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was up here right where our business is now, up Scipio Creek. And he had a boat just like mine. My dad was still living at that time. And he was He's gone on now. Really? Of course, he knew I was in trouble. We had no radio communication.
Mm-hmm.
He knew I was in trouble, and he was undertaking to take his boat and come hunting for me.
Yeah.
Of course, he wouldn't have got very far
mm-hmm.
because he would have been going into it. I was coming with it.
Right.
So I came on in, and I went up here, and we couldn't even tie up at the dock. We came to the dock because we got into cover, and so we came back up and then went on back up the river
mm-hmm.
until we went on up here and went into one of these creeks right
mm-hmm.
here, which is Huckleberry Creek, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right here, where the main river is. I believe this is it over here. Anyhow, we went on up and went out to Huckleberry Creek and we're safe.
Mm.
Fine.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You'll have to pardon me for being a little bit sentimental.
Well,
I
can quite understand, you know.
My brother was, and I was very close.
Yeah.
Very close.
Yeah.
That's right, so I've experienced a lot of bad weather and all, but early in my life, I decided that there was one greater than I, and I talked to him one day when I was a young fella, and I said, if you'll be my captain, I'll be your first mate.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since then, I guess I've been known as being one of the most successful commercial fishermen, and then the most successful in the industry of anybody along the coast. I take very little credit for myself, only that I applied myself. Mm-hmm. I studied it. I mm-hmm. worked hard. Mm-hmm. And I looked to wisdom, for wisdom from where it comes from. Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much for talking with me this morning. I know that your life represents much more than we have time to talk about today, and many more experiences, good and bad. But I do thank you for sharing these with me today, especially talking about the bay and how you see it through your experiences helps me think about it in a much broader way and over time than I would ever be able to obtain just in the short time that I'm here myself. And that really helps me a lot in understanding what happens here. Okay.
I don't want, and I've tried to stay away from throwing any criticism toward the people, which has got this thing.
Yeah, sure.
This is the end of the second and final tape of the October 9, 1986 interview with George Kervin. The interview was conducted at Kervin's home on St. George Island, Florida. The interviewer was David Taylor, and this interview was done in connection with the Maritime Heritage Survey Project. End of tape.